Hello, everyone. Welcome back, and thank you for joining us for episode 2 of our Tunisia podcast series. I encourage everyone to listen to episode 1 on our website, Tunisia's Amateur Autocrat, The Rise of Kais Saied. It provides a comprehensive overview of the internal political developments leading up to Saied's consolidation of power. I would like to once again thank the Carnegie Corporation for their crucial support in this production, as well as the support of our partners over at the Security and Context Network. This episode, Tunisia on the Global Stage, explores Tunisia's relationship with regional neighbors and the country's international standing. This episode will also briefly touch on the future of Tunisia's civil society and concludes with reflections on lessons learned from the Tunisian experience. I'd like to welcome back Tariq El-Majlisi. Thank you, Tariq. Continuing from where we left off, you had talked about Saied's relationship with the press and briefly introduced his engagement with European countries. And so I want to continue there. What has been the international reaction to, one, Saied's election, and then his gradual descent to dictator? What are the European relations with him? An American, for that matter.
Diplomatic way of summing it up would be muted concern. From the European side, at least, there was a great deal of fear about calling it a coup when it first happened. Even when his kind of constitutional process went through and it was farcical, you know, there were diplomatic moves that were made. So there's an organization called the Venice Commission that came in and did a report on the electoral environment in the country that was highly critical. This is the EU's way of criticizing. And Saied was very public in his rebuking of the Europeans for violating Tunisian sovereignty and so on and so forth. But you don't see the kind of big political statements that you would. And I think on a quiet level, on a working level, the Europeans aren't so fast. I mean, especially with countries who feel like that they are under the cosh of a migration crisis that they have to deal with, like the Italians, the Spanish, the French. They're all more than happy with this kind of notion of a strongman. I mean, they would say that, there is no political opposition. So Saied might be problematic, but he is the president of a country. We have to deal with the president. And they will not say anything about the political repression that's going on. I mean, even when some of these political opposition are arrested for holding meetings with European ambassadors, they will still rather not say anything to risk ruining their reputation with Saied, despite the fact that Saied is more than happy to throw them under the bus. So they feel a bit lost, to be honest. The USA has always been, ironically, because it's in Europe's backyard and it's not an important issue for the US, but the US was always the loudest in condemning the anti-democratic moves of Saied, calling publicly for him to go in a more democratic direction, to reverse some of the authoritarian steps that he's taking. Funding has been cut. And I think we got to the point in the US where they're like, you know what, it's not really our problem, right? So we're just going to cut our funding, we're going to cut our support, and we won't deal with them as much. And I think Congress in particular is making a lot of noise about the authoritarian moves of Saied and his kind of clamping down and all of that. But their problem, again, is that there's no political alternative right now. So the real linkage point that nobody wants to talk about or nobody wants to deal with is that, as we discussed before, Saied is enabled by his military and his interior ministry. The Tunisian military is a major non-NATO ally, which is quite a distinction to have for a military of the world. Mm. They are very close with their counterparts in the United States because they were partners in the war on terror. They have a lot of funding from the United States. They, do a lot of joint programs. They love it. It's their point of pride, but it's a point of leverage that the United States will not use. Mm. And similarly, the relationship between Europeans and the Ministry of Interior in Tunisia is a point of leverage that they will not use. So what we really get is muted condemnation, muted shows of concern, but nobody really wants to use their leverage to make anything happen.
You mentioned the migrant crisis. When it comes to migrants, refugees, asylum seekers, is Tunisia really a global player in this area?
Yes, yeah. Is the short answer. And the longer answer will take me into this kind of paradox of strongmans or dictators and so on and how they can be used. So right now, I think the number is roughly 120,000 people have crossed the Mediterranean from Tunisia so far this year, which is on par with the levels of 2015-16, which was considered the migrant crisis in Europe. Mm. And this is largely because of European policy with the Libyans and with other launch sites that migrants used to travel across. So the Europeans convinced themselves that by signing these deals with really shady armed groups in Libya who keep migrants locked up like animals with no human rights or no rights in general, that they have prevented migrants from reaching Europe. But really what they have done is that if you look at migration and people smuggling as a business model, they have done nothing to change the demand. They've just cut the supply. And so they've allowed people smugglers to raise the price of their business. And so it keeps flowing. It just flows at a lesser rate. And then eventually, you know, the exit route stopped being from Western Libya and moved to Tunisia. Mm. And so you have this whole industry which is flourishing and developing there. And that's my criticism on migrant policy. But now there is this relationship with Saeed, like the US and others had with President Sisi in Egypt after the massacre, whereby there's a belief that democracy is for us and dictatorships are useful for us because it creates a single strong man who we can deal with, who we have leverage over, and who is capable of getting things done. He maintains order in the country, so we don't have to worry about chaos, terrorism, migrants, and so on. But also, when we need something to get done, we can work through him. But the reality that we've seen across the entire Middle East and North Africa region, across the world in general, is that dictators are like parasites. They suck up all the value in the country and they offshore it for their personal benefit. And the things that they have to do to maintain power destroys the state, destroys societal harmony, destroys the economy, so that not only are they unable to get things done in the end, but also when they go, you are left with abject chaos and with a situation that's far worse than what you started. And this is what we're seeing in Tunisia now. The French, the Italians, others thought, okay, we got a strong man, we can work with him. But by enabling him and allowing him to settle in and still now trying to uncritically work with him and not look into political alternatives or not look into ameliorating the situation in any way. It just means that when Saeed fails, which is an inevitability at this point, it's going to be a much bigger mess to try and deal with for North Africa, for the rest of Africa, and for Europe. I mean, just quickly on the migrant point again, you know, the African Union was shocked and sub-Saharan and the rest of the continent was shocked. And there were people asking the African Union, like, why didn't you say anything about President Saeed saying what he said about the rest of the continent and about sub-Saharan Africans? And the response is quietly and usually is, well, you know, we in the African Union didn't ever think that we would have to deal with a problem of racism towards Africans. So we don't have any statutes or any laws or any conditions by which we can punish people for exhibiting that kind of racism. Mm-hmm. That's the ridiculousness of the situation that we are in now.
Do the Americans and the Europeans see, as you say, Saeed's inevitable failing? Are they actively changing their muted policy towards him, perhaps even becoming more critical? Maybe not now, but do you see this happening anytime soon?
I think it depends on where you sit. So, you know, Europe itself is divided. It's not a whole. If you go to Germany, for example, there is significant concern about Saeed, even about his authoritarian tendencies, the way he's arresting political opposition, clamping down on media and so on. You know, most people in the policymaking world in Berlin would not believe that it's a good idea to keep giving this guy money. And it's not a good look either. But if you go to somewhere like Italy, they have kind of convinced themselves that he's not that bad and the situation is not that bad because they need him to be not that bad. They need to have a partner in Tunisia that they can work with. They don't know what the alternative is. So this is what they have to deal with. And so, yeah, I think it depends on where you go. But I think an overall issue that the policymaking world has, not just in Europe, but all over the world, is that we are plagued with short-termism. We have a guy who's a president. He doesn't look like he's going to go by the end of the week. So we will do everything we can to work with him because that's who our partner of today is. And nobody thinks bigger picture than that.
Speaking a bit more regionally, what has been the reaction from the surrounding states towards Saïd? Is he liked by any of his neighbors?
I mean, he's not the most personable guy in the world. It's hard to build a friendly relationship with him. I think his best partnership is with the president of Algeria, President Tebboune. They seem to have an understanding. They seem to think that they can work with each other. But I think if you go beyond the presidency in Algeria, there is deep concern over Tunisia because it is a failing state. You know, Algeria is basically paying for Tunisia's electricity supply because they know that the Tunisians can't pay for it themselves. They just keep, you know, delaying the payment and giving them credit and so on. And I think that there's a significant concern over what the worst case scenario might look like there. I think in other countries, like if you go to Libya, their other neighbor, which is essentially just a klepto state right now, whereby, you know, those in control aren't really governors either. They're just engaged in kleptocracy. They see Tunisia as vulnerable and as somewhere which they can expand their business dealings through. So they're kind of happy with the situation. But, you know, while you had these Arab Spring countries in 2011 and this kind of push for political change, you did have a powerful counter-revolutionary force in the region as well that wants to roll back any kind of political progressiveness. And I think those guys are happy with Saïd. If you go to the Arab Gulf states, if you go to Egypt, they have, I think ideologically, they're happy with how Tunisia has ended up. They're happy with the concept of Saïd. If you look at their policy towards Tunisia, they're basically covering their own potential losses economically by extending him more money to pay back debts that he owes them. But Egypt in particular, the President Sisi has been very close to President Saïd. There are a lot of rumors that he helped him perform his coup in the first place. So yeah, depending on, well, actually, I should qualify that because that's quite a big statement. There were reports at the time that Egyptian army was helping the Tunisian army and they were helping others to enact the coup in the first few days. So there was a plan that was leaked at a regional newspaper, ironically a couple of months before the coup happened, that was warning of this exact plan. And that plan was carried out. And so at that time, there were reports of Egyptian officers and Egyptians there with the Tunisian counterparts. President Saïd had gone to Cairo a couple of times beforehand. So there is a lot of anecdotal evidence, but nothing hard and fast that shows that the Egyptians had a role.
How would having Saïd in power directly benefit Egypt to the extent that they possibly militarily intervened in helping him, you know, gain power?
I think it's an ideological affinity, firstly. Secondly, it's building a close relationship with Saïd. So, I mean, before President Tebboune came into power, you would say that President Sisi was Saïd's best friend, even before his coup. And this was part of a general Egyptian policy in the region of trying to grow their influence. You know, Egypt, so like, there's a line that people say about Egypt where, like, for the rest of the world, the president of Egypt is just the president of Egypt. In Egypt, president of Egypt is the leader of the world. You know, they call their country Umm al-Dunya, which is the mother of this earth. And so Egypt wants to be a regional power. And so growing influence in Libya, growing influence in Tunisia is their way of pushing back against other regional powers and kind of growing themselves. And I think you can see part of this in the relationship that they were building. But a lot of what happens in the region, unfortunately, is ideological. And so Saïd is similar to them, and birds of a feather flock together.
What about Saeed? What does Saeed want Tunisia to be? What's his trajectory for the country?
I could not accurately say. I mean, I think a lot of people try to predict, they try to project onto Saeed. So a lot of people will say, oh, you know, he's this old-fashioned Arab sovereigntist or Arab nationalist in the mold of Abdel Nasser in Egypt or people of that ilk. But I don't really see it, to be honest. And I think that, you know, he is very clear about him in Tunisia. So he is almost messianic. He believes that he is the embodiment of Tunisian public will and that he has this kind of divine mission to right the course of the revolution. He believes strongly in Tunisia's sovereignty, which is part of the reason why I believe he won't sign an IMF deal, because he doesn't like the concept or the symbology that any organization can be above the president of the country. So he doesn't want to take rules from them, even if those rules aren't bad for him or for the country. But when it comes to the dealings outside, you don't see much Tunisian foreign policy. And unfortunately, you know, they have a very good core of diplomats, but the Ministry of Foreign Affairs is not as active as it used to be. And I should say before, sorry, just quickly, I mean, like Tunisia is a small country. But so, for example, in the years before Saeed came to power, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs was quite active in trying to create regional harmony because they knew that they were a small player. So on the Libya crisis, for example, you always had Tunisia trying to balance between Algeria and Egypt and Morocco on the situation in their neighborhood. And so that was a valuable diplomatic role that they once had, which is just no longer there.
Why isn't it then?
Lack of direction. A government is like a machine. It needs to be turned on. It needs to be operated. It needs to be directed towards some kind of goal. And especially under Saeed, where everything has been centralized fully in his hands, there's just no policy direction coming down from there. And nobody wants to be seen to do anything only to have it be contradicted by the president because they know that they have no autonomy of their own. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the Tunisian state is now a bunch of ministries waiting for an order from Saeed that is never going to come.
This connects to a question I have about civil society. So if Saeed won't turn the state on, where does civil society come in with regards to jumpstarting the state, steering Tunisia in a new direction?
I mean, given the kind of domestic problems that the state is suffering from, civil society was always more directed towards trying to ameliorate those problems.
Yes.
And I think these days especially is what they remain focused on. But there is a real fear amongst civil society nowadays, especially with the emergence of the civil society law, that President Saeed is trying to cast them as a new enemy. So to cut all foreign funding to them, to basically cast them as being spies or being, you know, agents of foreign states, casting aspersions on them. And I personally think it's deeply destructive. I mean, not only is President Saeed killing a group that once welcomed his arrival because they thought that they could work with him. So, you know, like if you're a guy who's bad at policy and you have all these guys who are good at policy who want to work for you for free, you should work with them, not call them enemies and arrest them and throw them in jail. And it's indicative of Saeed's problems. But also, you know, because the state is hollowed out, because they have all these problems coming their way, like when crisis hits a country like Tunisia or Libya, it's civil society that are the first responders that kind of manage the response. Mm-hmm. And with Saeed gutting it, it kind of means that when crisis time hits, it's going to be a lot worse than it should have been.
This civil society law, when is he trying to pass this? Is this something that is definitely going to happen, or is there
He floated it a couple of years ago, and there was a strong pushback from the international community, from civil society, from the Tunisian street, and it kind of just got shelved. And this was before he had, you know, done his new constitution, had new parliamentary elections for an entirely kind of pliant and disempowered parliament. So now we're in a very different scenario, whereby it is his strong constitutional presidential system. He has got an entirely pliant parliament, and the law has resurfaced. And so now people don't see how it's going to be stopped. I think we could end up in a scenario of protest to try to pressure against it. Unfortunately, civil society in the region has come to learn that their Western allies are not always there when time gets tough. We've seen this in Libya, we've seen this in other places whereby nobody really looks out for them once they start getting arrested and cracked down on. So there's a lot of fear amongst civil society right now, which is why I felt bad for criticizing them earlier, because you know, no one wanted to end up in this place that we're in now. And I think there's a lot of concern about their future, their ability to work, but also their future, their own freedom in the future, because they might be arrested for these kind of activities.
Would the passage of such a law constitute a breaking point for civil society? And what kind of response, you know, could we reasonably expect? You know, mass protest, anything?
So any protest now has a very violent crackdown on it. And if it looks like it's going to be a protest movement, you know, you don't just get the violence at the moment. At, you know, 3 a.m. in the morning, the next day, people will be, you know, police will be breaking into homes and arresting people and so on. And because of that high price to pay, people are less willing to protest. But also it's hard to get the mass mobilization. People. I mean, even civil society is quite a niche world within Tunisia, or a particular class that's in it. There's been a lot of aspersions cast upon them over the years because different political powers feared them. So I think this is one of the reasons why Saeed thinks that they won't be too difficult a target to pick on. But if you want to have a revolution, you know, there's a saying in the academic world that you don't that hunger doesn't make for revolutions, otherwise the world would be in a constant state of revolution. You have to find something to shake the nihilism out of the broader population. And I don't really see what that is right now. There's such a resignation, and it's not just in Tunisia, it's in other Arab countries as well. But in Tunisia, you know, they'll say, what do you want us to do? Like, we tried the whole revolution thing, we tried the democracy thing, and now we try the dictatorship thing again. And it all ends in the same way, with a ridiculously high unemployment rate, spiraling inflation, lack of basic goods. I mean, you can't even get bread now. All bread has to be exactly the same standardized loaf now. So they've just kind of run out of ideas of what they can do.
I'm trying to inject a little hopefulness into the situation, in spite of it being hard to see that. But the Tunisian revolution itself, you know, the date, the time, the specific spark, that was impossible to prevent. So who's to say what will happen next week, next month, next year, you know?
No, I mean, you don't know where it will go. I think a lot of people always like to praise the resilience of countries like Tunisia. Like, oh, we thought it would collapse by now, but it's still going well. And like, resilience is the hopeful side, because you see people come together as communities and so on to deal with things that they shouldn't have to deal with, such as low supplies of bread and work and things like that. But yeah, you have to see that it gets to a situation eventually which becomes untenable. And perhaps that will prompt the kind of real introspection and action which is needed to make state functional again. Otherwise, you worry about what might happen.
Well, thank you so much, Tariq. Do you have any final words that you feel our listeners should take with them?
This is the political path, right? It's not always easy. If you're going to have a real democracy or a real representative political system, rather than one that's kind of parachuted in from somebody else's country and somebody else's historical experience, and this is the path you go down towards creating it, right? And Tunisia is not alone in the region in that. A lot of countries are going down a similar path. So the kind of optimistic line to look at is that this is just a process of learning. This is a process of development. It is very clear that the old ways of doing things that kind of started in the 1960s and 1970s in the Arab world are over. They are no longer functional. They are no longer fit for purpose. And so change will have to come at some time. There are powerful, wealthy forces in the region that are trying to stop all change from happening. But, you know, that is philosophically impossible. So we know that change is coming. This is just a process of learning how to improve and how to grow. And I think that there's an awareness as well amongst the population of the region of how alone they are. You know, they've learned that their supposed ideological allies in the Western world are not always there for them. They've learned that there has to be a certain amount of self-reliance. And so, yeah, these are constructive lessons in helping the region to be more sovereign and more capable of deciding what comes next. Now we just have to see how collaboration networks evolve. So, you know, a certain type of network had grown by 2011 that enabled the Arab Spring to take place. Since then, authoritarian states have been very good at kind of adapting to technology to turn them into tools of oppression. So now we have to see how the street evolves from there and what new networks and what new ways of coming together prop up. And I think that will be very interesting and very inspiring to see the evolution of kind of protest and planning for how to improve things.
Well, thank you so much for that, Tariq. And, you know, we look forward to having you on again.
Thank you very much, Omar, for inviting me and for this great conversation.